Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that this podcast is presented by mybookie.ag and that if you use the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, that you will get a 50% deposit bonus on your first deposit. And given that you are a listener to this podcast, I would assume you're relatively knowledgeable about sports, and I would trust you to try your edge on the online sportsbook. You can lay down some money and get in on the action at one of the safest online sportsbooks in the world. It's the only one that I am currently using. You can wager on all sorts of different outcomes on mybookie.ag, soccer, football, any major league, esports. You can even create your own player props, which is useful for me because if you know anything about me, I do enjoy a good player prop. So if you deposit using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K, you get a 50% bonus when you deposit. And I will add this for listeners of the TakeCast. If you deposit using the promo code MATTEK and you send proof of it to me on Twitter, I will follow you on Twitter and you can have access to me via DMs whenever you want. That's the TakeCast bonus that I'm adding in association with the mybookie.ag deposit bonus. Now let's get back to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. In this episode, I have Maria Marino from the FanDuel Hurry Up and Sportsnet New York on the show to talk about her path through sports journalism, how she ended up here, what it's like to interview pro athletes, what it's like to be a sideline reporter, what it's like to interview DFS players, some structural questions about the WNBA, and a lot of very interesting and varied topics over the course of an hour. I'm sure when you guys downloaded this episode, you noted the episode length. I think it's a very good episode that a lot of you are really going to enjoy. Maria was a fantastic guest and really drove at a lot of really important and really interesting topics for all of you to listen to. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can always leave a rating and review on iTunes, which is always very appreciated. And if you want some more bonus episodes of the show, more content, you can of course subscribe on patreon.com/takecast to get extra episodes, get ad-free episodes, and much more, as well as access to our Patreon-only Discord. And after a quick ad, we will get to the show. Hey everyone, just wanted to take a little moment out of the show to tell you about a new podcast that I have found called Token Talks, which you can find, wherever you listen to podcasts. On this show, we talk a lot about our content consumption habits, and I generally ask the guests, you know, what kind of podcasts you listen to? What are your podcast consumption habits like? So I found this podcast, wanted to let you guys know about it. The tone is a little bit different than what we normally do on the show, but I think the listeners that want to go deeper on certain aspects of the future of cryptocurrency and blockchain technology in general will find the show educational and engrossing. And yeah, just wanted to take a moment out of the show. And of course, thank you to Token Talks for, you know, reaching out. All right, everyone. Hello. I would like to welcome Maria Marino from the show. You probably know her from the FanDuel Hurry Up during the 2018 season. She did NFL and NBA fantasy content with them over the last year and is also a contributor at Sportsnet New York. She came very highly recommended to the show via Drew Dinkmeyer and Michael Leone. They begged me to have her on the show. So we went ahead and scheduled it and thought that we could get that done. Maria, how are you doing?
Well, I'm fantastic, especially now that you told me that my guys, Drew and Michael Leone, recommended me. Love working with them. With all the NBA fantasy content we did with Fantasy Sports Network. Here I am. Glad we can make it work. How you doing, Davis?
I'm doing great. They really are relishing their role as getting producing credit for this show now. They've just been they've just been suggesting to me guests that they really want to hear on the show over like the last couple weeks. Like Drew has me, you know, trying to get his friends on the show. So they're loving this executive credit. They're really enjoying the producer role.
It sounds to me like a great formula. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's great for me because it saves me the trouble of having to book guests. Like when you do an independent podcast, the hardest thing really is convincing people who are interesting to come on your show. But when other people are doing the introductions and setting up the intros for you, it really makes my job a lot easier because the hardest work in doing a podcast is getting people to come on it.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty flattered that you would consider me amongst the interesting folks that you could have on.
Well, I mean, I guess we'll see. I guess we'll see over the next 45 minutes or so how interesting you're able to make this interview. So the first thing I always ask the guests who come on the show basically is, why sports? And I guess for you more particular, why sports journalism? Everyone generally, I find, does have a pretty interesting story as to why they care about sports, why they decided to cover it. My take was always just I wanted people to know how right I was about things. So I really wanted to get into sports content production. But what was your journey like up into this point?
Well, it's definitely been a journey. And for me, it wasn't sports that came first. It was actually the idea of journalism that came first. So I feel like storytelling or the act of storytelling was always something that was interesting to me from a young age. And when I was in high school, I started writing for the school newspaper and editing. And I pretty much realized from there that that's what I wanted to pursue on the college level. And majored in journalism. And I feel like I didn't really know exactly which way to go with that in terms of like what my niche was going to be, what my specialty was going to be for content that I wanted to cover and stories that I wanted to chase, mainly because I have so many interests. After some stints in lifestyle content and local news content, I just realized that sports was the number one passion. You know, it was my passion probably from the start, but I had this, for some reason, I had this notion in my head that it would be like almost unrealistic to try to pursue. Eventually I found a pathway to get into it by way of radio, and Sirius XM radio is kind of the first place that gave me a shot in sports media on air, doing updates for them and various segments for their shows and social media projects. And I think for me, like, the main thing was once I got into a media job, it was building credibility in sports. So by working at Sirius XM and then eventually NBC Sports Radio as well, that got me some I wouldn't say clout, that sounds a little bit strong, but just credibility. Just, okay, I work in sports in a major media market in New York City and talk about national headlines and just establish some knowledge within that industry. And from there, got involved with Fantasy Sports Network, which was my first like regular on-air, on-camera sort of role, and that sort of propelled me into a different direction, which was video content. And I think that's really where my strong suit lies. And then from there was able to land some work with Sportsnet New York, which has been huge for me, huge breakthrough. Those all those little things.
Did you play a lot of sports growing up?
Yeah, always played sports growing up. I'm in like this sports obsessed family, I would say. Like, yeah. I'm one of five kids and my older siblings always played sports. They're a few years older than me and I loved going to their games and their matches and whatnot. They were big into basketball, which was my first love. And I remember, you know, picking up a basketball at an early age and being really competitive and enjoying that a lot. But then on the flip side, like my father was a huge sports fan, especially New York sports, big into the Giants.
Are you a Yankees or a Mets fan?
So I actually, I root for the Yankees, but I don't dislike the Mets, you know, and I'm the same way with like Giants, sure. Jets. I'm a huge Giants fan, but I don't dislike the Jets. I think any sort of rivalry sort of opinion about those teams is completely like false. I think that's a complete fallacy. But it's just that they're in the same town. And I think a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of Jets and Mets fans haven't done a ton of winning. So it kind of turns into this like, well, Giants and Yankees are just annoying. But I honestly want all New York teams to do well. Too bad it's been a while since any of them have done well. I mean, the Yankees have been, you know, mildly successful recently. I mean, obviously we know of their tremendous success over decades, but recently New York sports has been a little bit tough in terms of the competitive arena. But it's still a really, really great place to be. It's still New York.
Did you ever have a moment where you realized that you weren't good enough to keep playing sports? I have like a couple of very clear memories of realizing that I was I was too small. Like I just basically got to about 6th, 7th grade and everyone else just kept growing and I was the same size and I realized very early on that I was not going to be able to pursue like any sort of serious athletic pursuit.
Well, here's the thing. When I look back on it, I feel like I probably could have been good enough to play basketball or volleyball on a college level.
Yeah.
But there were a couple different things. Firstly, I knew, like I said, I knew really what I wanted to do from a very young age. And I knew that my passion was journalism. I really did. And so I pretty quickly determined that there wasn't really a point in me trying to pursue playing a sport at a college level. But at the same time, I was obsessed with volleyball, which was rough because my school didn't have a team. And I feel like that probably would have been my best shot at playing a sport at a higher level, but it just wasn't meant to be. There was just nowhere for me to compete until I became an adult. I still compete. Yeah. Now, what's funny is I know so many people that I went to high school with, that I went to college with, that were great athletes that don't compete at all in any way as adults. And I find that difficult because I crave like that competitive outlet. And even though I wasn't technically a college athlete, I feel like I compete on a weekly basis playing volleyball, and I do tournaments and like I do all these things that like you would think that maybe I would have played at a higher level. But funny enough, when I was in high school, again, because I knew sort of the path that I wanted to pursue, like I stopped playing basketball after my sophomore year because I wanted to do like the school play. And like what's funny is, you know, those skills really did eventually help me.
You definitely are profiting more off of those skills than off of your volleyball skills now.
Well, I'm only profiting as of recently, Davis. I would say that's been a struggle in terms of making ends meet for a while to try to make it in this business, but it's all worth it because it's what I like to do. But yeah, definitely there were a lot of skills that I picked up on through performing, through performance art. And like, you know, acting classes and theater and stuff like that. And, you know, I think there's an element to, I always say there's an element of being a performer. And that to me comes from my background in playing sports, because I do think athletes are performers. You know, they have to perform under pressure. They have the skill, but they, at the end of the day, have to go out there and execute. And same thing with performance art. And, you know, being in front of the camera when the lights are on and actually executing in that arena as well.
Yeah. So something that we talk about a lot on, well, you know, actually when you were bringing that up, that was making me realize a lot of people who play DFS probably come at it from like a very similar background of just needing to still compete at something. And like, obviously there is the financial incentive, but like the competitive aspect of like winning versus losing, yeah, and there being very clear outcomes. I think probably a lot of people who listen to this podcast and play DFS come at it from a similar mindset of just needing, yeah, to compete at something and having a measuring stick.
Right. Well, I think having a competitive mindset is something that you benefit from in all aspects of life. And it just so happens that I pull inspiration from playing sports, from watching sports. And I also pull in inspiration from just competing against myself and just wanting to be the best that I possibly can at everything that I put my time and effort into doing. Now I also like to win. So I think, sure, that's fun. And I think when you talk about DFS or any fantasy sports, like you play because you want to win, and you want to arm yourself with all the tools and knowledge necessary to show out and do well. So, and then that's fun, you know, so yeah. the fun comes with that.
So something that we talk about a lot on this show is branding, which is, yeah, like a lot of social media presence, on-camera personality, or just being affiliated with successful companies and operations. How do you define your brand, or is it even something that you really focus on, or is that kind of something that's been secondary for you over the years?
Well, brand is, that's like a technical term. For me, it's very simple. It's kind of like the root of that, which is just me being me. I think anyone who wants to have their quote unquote brand needs to be themselves first, needs to be authentic. That to me is like the most important foundation to a brand, is knowing who you are, knowing what you're about, and you tailor your content to that. I think people that consume media nowadays are extremely savvy, and I think they can spot inauthenticity.
Definitely, yeah.
Like right away. And I think, you know, the same sort of marketing techniques that were used 5 years ago, 10 years ago, are just not effective anymore, because people want real content. They want real conversation. They don't want scripted sort of stuff. And I think anytime you follow someone on social media, any sort of public figure, like an athlete, an actor, politician, all these things, like the reason that you're following them is because you want that like behind the scenes look at their life, and you want to see their actual real day-to-day life. You don't want to turn on the TV and see like what some, like a bunch of producers in a room decided that you should see. You want to see what's actually happening. And so for me, like I am more active in terms of being conscious of staying away from things that are not me. But I don't, it's not like I think I put too much thought in the types of things that I'm posting and sharing, because I really am just sharing what's interesting to me, and it's what I'm about. But I do try to be aware of not getting sucked into things that I think might get me more followers, but really isn't me. Like for instance, you know, I'm a woman, and I'm on, you know, different media outlets, and there's definitely,
I mean, just the experience of being a woman on social media. I mean, we don't have to do a show all about what it's like, you know, a woman in particular, but certainly I am curious what your experience on social media is like versus what you think your peers experience.
I'm very aware of the fact that posting a photo of myself is probably going to get, you know, maybe more likes than like posting a photo of like a freaking football field or something like that. You know, but it's not even just the fact that I'm a woman. I think that's most people, like you show yourself. I think that's mostly what people want to see, but like, I don't want to post a photo just because I think I look hot. Like that's counterintuitive, sure, to what I'm trying to do. For me, it's all about substance over style. And so, yeah, I want to try to look cute, but I also want to have something valuable.
Don't we all? Today. Don't we all want to try and look cute?
Yes. Yes. But when I say look cute, I don't mean like something that's completely unrealistic. Like, I want to show what I am about. I don't want to see like this like retouched, filtered nonsense. I really like, I can't stand it. I think it's a major, major problem. I personally stay away from any filters that like alter my features in any way. When you see like a filter that like makes your eyes look bigger or makes your nose look smaller or your lips look more plump, I think that freaks me out. It's not natural.
Yeah.
I have like a hard rule against that. And so that's one aspect of it. Like, I try not to be like too revealing in what I wear, because that's not what I wear day to day. Like, what you see is what you get in terms of what you're going to see like in person and what you're going to see on my social media pages. I hope that that's like parallel. And then when I, you know, going back to this idea of like substance over style, you know, I want to share things that I care about. I want to share my opinions. I want to share things that I feel like are going to bring some value to whatever the overall narrative is. So like, whatever the story is, whatever is happening, like, let me try to bring you some perspective that you might not have otherwise thought of. Like, let me show how I care about this issue, show my passion for this issue. And you know, I don't want to make it seem like it's all of that. Of course, there's fun stuff too. You know, I think it's important to show like life outside of work and yeah, relationships and, you know, things, hobbies. Like, you know, I was just in Florida for a vacation, and, you know, I don't play volleyball for a living, but I like to play recreationally, and I posted some clips from that. And I like people to see who I am when the camera's not rolling. And I don't know. What do you think? I think that kind of sums it up, right?
I mean, I can't tell you what your subjective social media experience is like, but I just think that it's an interesting discussion to have, because obviously a lot of the people that I have on the show cannot, I mean, you can't talk intelligently about an experience that is not your own. And it is something that I think is pretty interesting, because really any time that there is a woman, you know, in the sports journalism field, I think that their experience is, I think objectively their experience is different than what a right man in the field of sports journalism would experience.
Right. Well, and we'll get more into that, but on a quick side note, just in terms of like social media strategy, I think it's kind of important to also recognize who your audience is, who you want your audience to be, and also like what medium you're using. Like, I post different things to Instagram as I do to Twitter, as I do to Facebook, and I know kind of who my audience is in each specific realm. So I think it's just important for people to think about that when it comes to trying to hypothetically build some kind of brand or following.
Yeah. And I think that's all pretty, a lot of stuff that's not been talked about before. Something that I was pretty curious about is your experience as a sideline reporter. I had Dan Orlovsky on the podcast maybe 4 or 5 months ago, and he kind of talked a little bit about what it's like to be in the booth and, you know, the challenges that come along with that. But what is the experience of being a sideline reporter like, being that close to the action and then trying to draw, you know, you're trying to take like the high level, the 1,000-foot view of what's happening right in front of you and translate that experience to the audience?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge. I've said this before, but I'll say it again. I think being a sideline reporter is a role that's somewhat underappreciated, and it's heavily criticized because it's an easy target, I think, for people when they're watching games to look at and say, oh, that, you know, that's a stupid question, or, oh, like, why do we need this? Why do we need to talk to a coach like at halftime or on their way to the locker room when they don't really want to be there? So I think it's right from the start kind of a tough spot to be in.
Yeah.
That you really have to make the most of. And you sort of alluded to it. You have a very tight window of time to try to convey some sort of information that's going to be valuable to the viewer. But in terms of what it's like on the sideline, it's pure chaos. I mean, I was on a college basketball sideline covering the UConn men's program, which was sort of my first time doing sideline on a that sort of scale for a network and for a program of that caliber. But I mean, if you can imagine, I always say, I think college basketball is a very, very tough atmosphere for athletes. I think it's one of the toughest because you're in a packed arena and the fans are like, they really feel like they're right on top of you. And you can hear what they're saying. And it's just so, it's so up close. So it's loud in there and there's pep bands and it's actually hard to hear yourself think. And on top of it, I'm trying to like analyze the game and what's happening in front of me. I'm trying to then tie that into any sort of stories and background information that I might have gathered on my end previously and like figure out how I can connect the dots and share something once again with the viewers that that they might not have realized. And so it's certainly challenging, but it's definitely a fun place to be. It's like a whirlwind. The game just flies and you know, with a couple minutes left in the half, I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to ask the coach? You know, with a couple minutes left in the game, I'm thinking to myself, who is the star of this game? Who do I want to interview after? Again, what am I going to ask the coach? You know, I'm trying to find opportunities to be heard because, again, like the sideline reporter, you don't go to them that often.
Right.
So I feel like it's not like my producer is going to sit there and be like, and like spoon feed me opportunities to come and be on camera. Like I have to bring it. I have to say, hey, you know, I listened to the huddle and this is what I gathered. Like, what do you think? I try to be proactive in that regard. You know, trying to keep my eyes and ears really open and look for any potential opportunity for me to share something. And also I try not to shy away. Like if there is an instance where my producer says, do you have something on this? Like, I really want to take every opportunity I get. I don't really want to turn down chances to bring something to the broadcast because I think it's easy as viewers to kind of forget about the sideline reporter. And then finally, and I'm rambling like crazy, but I guess that's what I'm here for. Like, I think another sort of challenge that I have in general, and this is not just with sideline reporting, but any sort of on-air role on different types of programming, is the role that you expect the female to play. I have a real problem with that. And I have a problem trying to be fit into a role that right. I feel is only because a woman is expected to do it. And I'm not saying that all sideline reporters are women. That's not the case. There are a lot of really great male sideline reporters. I just think that we automatically think of a woman as a sideline reporter as opposed to play-by-play or color. And I think that's something that's starting to change. I personally love a lot of female
Yeah, Doris color, Burke. Color Doris Burke is a legend.
Doris Burke's a legend. I mean, Doris Burke, in my mind, is a much better... I mean, I love her on sideline, don't get me wrong, but I love her on color. She is, like, my favorite color commentator. And you know who else is great? I think Kara Lawson is fantastic on color commentating. That's just a couple of examples. But I also love seeing... You know, when I see Candace Parker sit in on the NBA on TNT pre-half post show, that gets me very excited because she's somebody that knows the game. I want to see more women in analyst roles, not just, you know, traffic controlling.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
anyway.
I think that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, and these are all things that are slowly but surely changing in terms of, you know, what our expectations are. And what stereotypes are, and you know, it starts also with the stuff behind the scenes and management and being an executive and being in a decision making role. You know, when you have more women in those types of roles, all of these other sort of trickle down effects occur, and it's like, okay, well, why don't we put this woman here instead of here, and also why don't we talk about what we're covering, and you know, maybe let's cover this sport more because it's a female sport. So it's like all these things. And I don't want to sound like that's like my like MO, because it's really not, my MO is just to be, again, just to be me. I'm passionate about sports. I don't like when people are like, oh, like, how did you get into sports? Like, it's such a big surprise. Like, I got into sports the same way you got.
Same way you did. Yeah. Your dad liked sports. You watched it growing up. You played it growing yeah. up. And that's not yeah. something that's, I guess, probably a lot of people think that that's unique to the male experience.
Well, I will say this. And like, as much as I want to try to live in this idealistic world and make it seem like it's all good and it's all the same, it's a really tight rope to walk because I don't want to seem over dramatic, but I also want to clue you in as to my experience and to make you like, understand where I'm coming from, because it is different. And I'll tell you what, I feel that my gender has put me at a slight disadvantage in this industry. And I don't mean it because of necessarily the opportunities that I've been given or that are available. I mean, and just in terms of my knowledge, because when I first got into this, like, people that I knew that were friends of mine that don't work in sports media, that don't even play sports, knew more than me, because when they were kids, they watched every single game.
Right.
You know, they did everything. Like, for me, you know, my parents, my father in particular, it's not like he ever wanted to shy me away from sports, but it wasn't also like he said, you know, he kind of molded me into it. It was me having an interest and pursuing it, and then him fostering that interest as opposed to forcing it on me, which I do feel like a lot of kids, a lot of boys when they're young, like, it's like this natural thing.
Yeah, they're, you know, like, you're gonna play football, you're gonna play baseball, you're gonna play soccer.
Right. And, yeah. and not even just that, but just following and being fans. Like, I remember, like, just having, like, conversations in school where, like, I didn't know anything. And, like, these dudes are talking about the NBA and the NFL every single day. So it was like, I didn't start following the NBA and watching religiously until I was, like, I mean, it was after college. Like, I was always yeah. interested in it, but it wasn't until I realized, like, how much I liked it. Like, no one put that in front of me. I found it and discovered it on my own, and I was really behind. Like, I had to study and watch and listen and absorb all of this information as much as I possibly could for years before I felt like I was on the same level in terms of, like, knowledge as my male peers. And on top of it, my historical context is lacking. Like,
yeah, you're missing out on a lot of the references to, like, football games that happened in 1998, because that's just not a part of, like, your cultural zeitgeist.
Right. And not so much now, but when I first got started, I just remember being, like, at SiriusXM, and not to mention the fact that there was, like, 18 or 20 sports anchors and only two of them were women, and both were part-time, and one, like, hardly ever worked, and I was the other one. And, like, I was in a room with all dudes, and I just remember thinking to myself, I don't know what they're talking about. Let me Google this real quick, like, secretly, so I know what they're talking about. Like, that's how it was when I first got started. Now, you know, I'll talk you under the table, but I also, like, recognize that, you know, I still have to get better in terms of history.
I mean, yeah, but I think that's probably a part of, like, a lot of people's experiences. And I don't know if that would probably be not unique to a female experience, but unique to someone who went from being a, you know, a capital J journalist into yeah. being a sports journalist. Probably just there's a lot of very small stuff and a lot of references that
yeah.
are not, like, cultural backhand, but they are in the world of sports.
Yeah. And, anyway, I don't know. I hope that kind of gives you some, just sort of some insight into my background. That's, I don't know. I just feel like there's certain things that people just don't realize, don't think about. But I had to grind for a long time, not just, to get, you know, opportunities and to become good at my craft, but also to become knowledgeable. And I had to really, really, like, immerse myself in it. Which, you know, I think you have to do in any profession to be truly successful. But I did truly feel when I got started that both my age and my gender put me at a disadvantage to my competitors, and I had to work doubly hard to make up for that.
Hey guys, I just wanted to take a moment out from the show to tell you about our proud sponsor, DailyRoto.com. You guys know that I have joined up forces with Daily Roto and Roto Experts full time and wanted to communicate to you a little bit about their golf product. Of course, with your premium subscription to Daily Roto, you get their amazing NFL, NBA, and MLB tools. They have also partnered with DataGolf to provide the best customizable projections for PGA DFS, as well as outright top 5 and top 20 betting. Using their tools, you can calculate the EV for outright top 5 and top 20 bets, as well as create the best and most customizable projections for PGA Daily Fantasy in the industry. You can save 10% on your subscription using the promo code RORY right now. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I think all of that seems, I guess, pretty straightforward, kind of along those lines. A more lighthearted question.
Okay.
Who is more difficult to try and make sound interesting, professional athletes or DFS nerds like Dink and Leonie and myself? Who is harder to pull the best soundbite out of?
Oh, this is like a trick question. First of all, I just want to say... Drew Dinkmeyer and Michael Leone and everyone else from Daily Roto.
Yeah, they're the best, but they're boring the nerds.
No, well, see, here's how I feel, okay? It's not so much that the subject is should be interesting on their own, but as a journalist or as an interviewer, I really feel like it's your job to pull something out of that subject to make it entertaining. And that starts well before the interview. So it's a matter of making that person feel comfortable, establishing a rapport, joking around a little bit, making it fun, making it humorous. And I sure hope, and I think they could probably speak to it, Ricky Sanders too, and, you know, some of the other guys I've worked with recently, like, I think they could tell the second that I start talking to them, like, I'm just really goofy and silly, and I just, like, try to BS with them before the segment or the camera even starts rolling, because I feel like it's like anything else. You need like that warm up, right? You need everybody to just feel comfortable. And that's what I do with athletes as well. Now, athletes have the benefit of, you know, being that household name where it's like, if you see, I interviewed Ben Simmons, you're like, oh snap, I don't even care what they might've been talking about. It's Ben Simmons. I got to watch it. Now, so the challenge with guys like, you know, the Daily Roto guys is like, they have to bring value aside from, like, they don't have the benefit of like that household name necessarily. I mean, they granted their Twitter followings are pretty.
Yeah. Drew has a lot of Twitter followers
through the roof, but I just mean like they have to bring it with their knowledge. Like they have to really put research in, and I respect the heck out of them for that. But yeah, I just, when it does come to athletes as well, when I've done interviews, I really, like I said, I do sort of like a pre-interview where I don't just like stand there and be like, and like be silent and then starts rolling. So how is this? Like, no, I walk up and I'm like, hey, what's up? What's going on? Like, how you feeling today? And I just try to small talk with them. Just let them know that like I'm friendly and I'm, I care about them. I really do. And so I think establishing a bit of trust is everything. There is an art, and I'm not saying that I'm great at it. I think I'm okay at it, and I'm still getting better and better. But like, there are certain people, like when you see interviews on TV or you see interviews on like digital content of like these professional athletes or whatever, like the people that are doing them, I think their talent, the people that are conducting the interviews, it's not always so apparent. Like you don't realize how much effort that might have actually taken in terms of making that subject feel comfortable and allowing them to open up and get some interesting soundbite.
Yeah, I don't think it's easy. Like I've had a couple pro athletes on the show, and those were like harder agendas for me to come up with than. And there's like a little bit of an intimidation factor too, of just like, it's kind of easier to just like chat with one of my buddies about football or whatever than it is to like ask, you know, very serious questions of someone who does like a very serious job.
Yeah, of course. But you know, what we fail to remember sometimes is that these athletes are people, and they have senses of humor. And, you know, I think a lot of it is sort of, I mean, it's cliche, but like the whole idea of what you say versus how you say it. I think there's a way to approach questions where it doesn't sound like a scripted question. It sounds just like you and I are talking right now, where we just talk. Like, I just ask you a question. It's just a conversation. It's not like, I don't know. It's not like your straightforward response. I think when it feels conversational, when it feels natural, these athletes are able to provide their most natural answer. And then, and again, that goes back to the content and wanting it to feel and be and come across as less contrived and less manufactured.
I mean, I think in general, trying to be the least amount of contrived you can possibly be,
for sure,
or the least amount of manufactured you can possibly be.
Definitely.
Like, people respond to that too. Like, people can tell when you are putting on something, I think.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, look, there are challenges that sometimes prevent that in terms of like, okay, you have a segment that needs to be X amount of minutes long, or even like the videos I've done for Daily Roto and for Fantasy Sports Network and stuff. It's not like I necessarily have all the time in the world to like converse and make it be this fun thing, but I try to just kind of vary up my wording. I understand I have to get this certain questions across, but you know, I just try to not sound scripted. And what's great about like the content I did with Fantasy Network, it's not like I use a teleprompter. I think that's something that people would ask me a lot, and would ask like my colleagues, like Greg Sussman and Frank Stample, and like things that we did where it'd be like, are we using a teleprompter? It's like, no, like that we're just talking, and you know, that doesn't mean that we don't mess up, because we definitely do. I'm happy that was the case, because it forces you to not overthink it and not sound too perfect. This is something I struggled with for a long time, because I am a perfectionist, but I realize I've come to understand and respect the fact that perfection sounds completely ridiculous. Like, perfection sounds like robot, like robotic. Right. Like, so actually I'd much prefer, to me, like imperfection is actually ideal in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, just the more real it is, like people just appreciate, even if there are like small errors or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, people appreciate that, I think.
Well, yeah, I think they like to know that you're human. You know, they like to know that you're not just like this talking head, like, you know, look and sound so polished all the time. So
it's definitely not the product that I put out on this podcast. So I have to believe that people don't always like the most possible polished product.
Perfect. By the way, I have no idea how long we've been going. If you just let me know if I'm rambling too long.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Probably like 30 minutes, maybe.
I say as long as it's interesting, we keep going. We stop when we stop.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. At some point, I'll probably run out of things to say. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I was curious about is, what has your experience been like with sports betting and DFS? Like, okay, when you got the job, were you like, oh, this is something that's interesting, or this is a pain, but I need to learn what it is? Like, what has your experience been like with the product? And then I guess, again, with like when sports betting became legal?
Okay, so there's definitely a story here. There's like a progression that happened with me. So I started in, like I said, in sports media. My first sort of exposure to anything like this was just, you know, season long fantasy football, right?
Yeah.
Which I had never done. And when I started working in sports media, some people started encouraging me to do it, and I was definitely skeptical, but then I was like, okay, you know, I have to get into this one, because it'll only just improve my knowledge of the game overall. And two, because it's such a popular topic, I'm like, I'd be stupid not to like get in on this and make sure I like know what's going on. So it started with like season long fantasy. Then, because of sort of my interest in basketball and DFS being huge with NBA, I started paying attention to that. And doing sort of like the Daily Roto videos and really paying attention to like fantasy output of certain players, following the NBA fantasy account like really thoroughly. As far as me playing myself, at first I didn't really, because it wasn't necessarily my job. Like, I was more like of a hosting role where I would let Drew and Mike Leone and like all these other pros, I would let them kind of provide the insight. And, but I did a lot of specials with Fantasy Sports Network that I was able to bring just like my generic NBA knowledge and couple that with my understanding of the rules and therefore be able to give what I felt was decent analysis. But I didn't start really truly playing DFS until last summer when the NBA said, hey, like, we could use somebody to talk about WNBA DFS. And I just thought that was a good opportunity for me to learn something new. And in fairness, like, I hadn't followed the WNBA that closely, but I was like, okay, this is like, this is a, the perfect excuse for me to like really dive deep into the WNBA. And I was able to create daily DFS videos with advice for like each like slate that night. And then I started really getting into it, and I really played every time that I gave a lineup on one of my videos. I played that lineup myself because I wanted to see like how I was doing and wanted to make sure I was giving good advice. And I definitely felt like I won more than I lost. I feel like, you know,
well, here that's and there, the goal. Get, here, that's the goal.
Yeah. Here and there you get bit by some things, and there's definitely some challenges like injury information. I think in the WNBA is a little bit harder to come by, just information in general. So that's challenging, but I definitely got into playing that pretty heavy. And then when it comes to betting, okay, so here's the thing. When people, because people would still talk about betting a lot even before it was technically legal in most places.
Not technically legal in most places. Like, you would not know that by like hearing the conversation, but like, I live in Missouri, which actually is one of the states that even on some of the online platforms, like, you're still banned from, but no one ever talks about it like that. They're just like, oh no, it's legal everywhere, you can do it.
Well, I think the reason that they talk about it is essentially what happened is like the law was changed in terms of saying like, we can't prevent states from making this legal. And so it's been a process. A lot of states obviously have adopted it already. Some are taking time, but to me, it's only a matter of time before all of these states have it legalized. And as far as the national platforms go, it's a massive, massive topic because people have been interested in it for a long, long time. And now there's not as much of a stigma around it. But in terms of me personally, I avoided it for a little while. I sort of didn't want to become too savvy about it at first. It was a little bit painful for me. I just had trouble wrapping my brain around certain, just certain aspects of it. Like, honestly, I didn't think it came very naturally to me, but obviously, when this sort of storm.
Well, it's very math based, and a lot of that doesn't come really natural to me either, but I just love the gambling sports, so I guess you just have to learn.
Yes, and full disclosure, math is not my strong suit. I was a little, again, it was kind of like with the fantasy thing too. I was a little bit skeptical at first, but then I started kind of forcing myself to get interested in it. And obviously when the storm hit of like, everybody's now doing gambling content, everyone's doing betting content, I was like, I better make sure I know what's up. And again, with FanDuel, we would do like every Friday, I would do, make picks. I wouldn't make the picks, but I would get picks from our experts like Gabe Morenci and whatnot. And even with SNY before the Super Bowl, we did it like this special previewing the big game in terms of like all of these different prop bets and stuff. And it is, I have to say I've adopted it more, and I look forward to getting more well-versed in it. I would be silly to think that it wouldn't continue to like just skyrocket in terms of demand.
Yeah, oh, it definitely will. And I think that is a good natural transition to talking about the WNBA, because it's something that you are passionate about, and definitely something that I wanted to talk to you about, which is clearly the league, I think, makes money. and definitely has a big amount of its funding come from the NBA. So why do you think that the revenue share for the players is so bad? Do they just not have a good collective bargaining agreement? Do you think there are solutions to this? Like, what are ways that the WNBA can have a more fair structure and also continue to like promote the game to a large audience?
Oh boy, Davis, you are opening up some kind of can of something, some kind of Pandora's box. I don't know. This is your floor. I know, this is my floor. So I'm going to try to be as articulate as I possibly can. But there's just so many angles to this. So I guess I should start by saying that not only is the differential between NBA and WNBA incomes extremely staggering. I mean, extremely. Like, when you talk about, like, the highest paid WNBA player earning, like, a little over $100,000, and then you have players in the NBA, you know, earning 20-plus million, it's not even just that. It's the fact that, like, WNBA players are also underpaid compared to, like, everyone, not just
right. Yeah, it's not just compared to the NBA. They're
yeah,
just
like
generally
you have
underpaid.
you have like WNBA athletes that are earning significantly less than like the average median income in the U.S. So that's one thing. You talked about the revenue share, and I think that's really important. I think a lot of people don't realize, because they'll all say, well, the WNBA doesn't make as much money as the NBA. Yeah, well, we know, but the NBA athletes earn about 50% of the NBA's, you know, revenue, as opposed to the WNBA athletes earning, like, from what we know from the records that are out there, like, less than 25% of the WNBA income, or I'm sorry, the WNBA revenue. So that's an issue. Collective bargaining for sure is an issue. I think part of the problem is subconsciously, I think sometimes female athletes just feeling so darn lucky to be able to pursue their dream and play.
I think that is a big part of it. I think that there's like a big part of the market that just takes these people for granted.
Well, I mean, look, you hear about it all the time, not just with the WNBA, but when you hear about like the wage gap in general from females to males, and sometimes there's the idea that, well, women traditionally haven't negotiated as strongly, or haven't asked for more. Now I don't know about all that. You know, that's just an idea that's out there, and there might be something to that. That could be a factor. Look, we know that the length of the season is, you know, less than half of what the NBA season is. Understand that. But you have female athletes earning just significantly more to play overseas, which I just find very curious, because, you know, we're the United States and we're supposed to be progressive and we're supposed to be about,
we invented, you know, basketball.
I know. And it would be
like the MLS being the highest paying soccer league in the world or something.
Right. And yeah, which we obviously know is the opposite. And like, I find it interesting that people, you know, overseas are willing to pay more to financially support pro basketball female players than here, you know, here in their home country. What people also need to understand is, you can't just compare the NBA to the WNBA. You just can't, because the NBA has been around way longer, number one. Number two, we obviously know all of the barriers that, like, women have faced over the years that they've had to overcome. And, like, you know, I don't want to hear that, like, the WNBA is like, oh, it's not popular. Like, if you look at the popularity growth and the ratings and stuff, for a league that's only 22 years old, it's actually pretty solid, you know. And when the NBA was 22 years old, you know, they weren't making a ton of money either. And I know
the NBA finals used to be tape delayed. They used to be showed on legit tape, like hours yeah. later, days later. Like the NBA as like a hugely successful business product, honestly, it hasn't even been a hugely successful business until like the last decade. These teams used to lose yeah. money.
And look, I understand that it's not so simple as making that comparison. Times and eras have changed, and the way we consume media has obviously changed, and all these things. So again, this is not like an apple to apple comparison. It's just not. It's complicated. But the bottom line is that the NBA gets more revenue from their TV deals. And the WNBA, you know, ESPN has started to pay more for TV rights to the WNBA. The WNBA now has deals with Twitter and like NBA TV, where they're starting to get some more exposure, and the ratings have been growing. They really have. So that's something that I feel like it needs to be debunked. And then on top of it, just like people's mindsets, like, I can't tell you, I get more people, like, we talk about being a woman on social media, I get more people ripping the WNBA.
Yeah, like, people go out of their way to just be like, who would care? Who
exactly.
watches this? This is so dumb.
And I can't, like, that to me is the most egregious thing. Like, you just go out there and assume that because you don't care about something, there aren't other people that care about it. Like, there is a sizable portion, there is a sizable audience that cares a lot about the WNBA. And frankly, if you like basketball, I don't understand how you aren't impressed by the athletes that are playing at the highest level. These are elite athletes. If you look at Candace Parker play, if you look at Elena Delladon play and Breanna Stewart and some of these, like,
Delladon is my favorite. She's so good.
Dude, like, I just can't even tell you. And I was naive to this. I really was. Until I actually started sitting down and watching games. As a basketball fan, as a basketball junkie, I enjoy watching WNBA games. And it's not just because I'm a woman and because they're females. It actually has nothing to do with that. It's because they're basketball players. And because I like good basketball. And I like fundamental basketball. And, like, just the stuff that they have to deal with. There's so many haters out there that, and like, the haters aren't NBA players. These NBA players respect the hell out of these female athletes.
I think that's a really good point, actually, is like, I don't know if I've ever heard a current NBA player say something disparaging about the WNBA, but I have seen a lot of them say encouraging things, like say that they watch the game, say that they support the girls. Like, I think that's a very good point.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, it's been awesome. I've seen, like, LeBron tweeting. I remember he was tweeting during, like, the WNBA playoffs, and, like, Isaiah Thomas has, like, a, you know, Seattle background, and obviously the Storm won the championship this past year, and he was, like, tweeting all about, like, if you looked at what Sue Bird did, oh my goodness, like, the type of career is just absurd. And again, I just want to stress, like, elite athletes playing at the highest possible level of competition to me is so impressive. And I think where people get caught up is they constantly, again, they compare the men's game to the women's game. These are so different. Like, it's just,
but these are also the same people that say that they really like college basketball because the, you know, the fundamentals and the teams play good defense and everything. It's just purely done as just like, it's just to be an asshole.
Well, maybe. And it's also being ignorant and lazy. You know, yeah. And it's you know, it's like, have you watched games? Like, are you commenting or have you actually watched games? But that's one thing. So that's one element, which is the psyche of people and sort of misconceptions and stigmas that are slowly being kind of broken down. The other aspect of it is media coverage. And this is where I want to really drive something home. I refer to media coverage of anything as something that I just, this is how I connect it in my brain, but I call it like the chicken and the egg approach, right? What came first, the chicken or the egg, right? I promise I'm going somewhere with this. You don't know about it because it's not being covered, but it's not being covered because people think that you don't want to know about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like in other words, like there are decision makers, there are that are making editorial decisions saying, let's bump this WNBA segment or this WNBA story because it's more important to show XYZ. Well, maybe it would be more important to show WNBA stuff if people were more aware of it because they get used to seeing it more and more. So in my opinion, there needs to be directive for storytellers to make room in their broadcast, in their podcast, in their articles, in their whatever, for WNBA stories. Like when I was an anchor, and I'm guilty of it too, when I was a sports anchor for SiriusXM and I had a 2-minute update and I had to fit all of the national sports, I was ashamed at times when I felt like I couldn't fit in a WNBA score.
Yeah.
Because I need to get in every single Major League Baseball score. And
yeah, who cares? I haven't watched a baseball game that I don't have money on or that was not the Kansas City Royals in like 3 years.
Look, here's my point. Like, there's no reason why we shouldn't have time or make time in these different media platforms to tell these stories because they are interesting. We talked about this earlier in the podcast as far as women being in executive roles, both within organizations, so I mean like teams, and within media. Now, if every single person in the room is a man that's making a decision as far as what's being shown, and I'm not saying we give jobs to people that don't deserve them. I'm just saying like, you need a diverse perspective in all aspects, not even just gender. I just think when you have a diverse room full of people, you're going to show things a lot more diversely and just like, I don't know, just have a better effort in terms of like not doing what's expected, thinking outside the box, not doing the same old formula. Again, like all of these things are slowly but surely changing. But as far as the WNBA and the type of revenue they're able to pull in, you need people that are open-minded, that are making these decisions within teams, within media. And you need to actually put time into being creative and promoting. Like,
The resources used to promote the NBA are not even close to the same resources that are used to promote the WNBA. And there's been this whole, like, there's this whole cottage industry around the NBA that has nothing to do with the product that takes place on the court. It's about the trades and the buyout market and free agency and, oh, where's LeBron playing next year?
Yeah.
Is he going to get traded? Like, I know a lot of my friends in, like, real life, not sports friends, they know a lot about the NBA in terms of, like, who plays for who or who's going to be traded here, but they haven't watched a regular season game all year long.
Totally. Hashtag NBA Twitter is popping. And I think, honestly, WNBA, like, if you look at their Twitter following, if you look at their Instagram following, it's great. It's great engagement and all of that, but I just think there needs to be more cross-promotion. I want to see some more WNBA content on NBA channels. And I know it's done to an extent, but you know, when somebody does something as impressive as like Breanna Stewart this year was a finals MVP, she was a league MVP, and she was an FIBA Women's World Cup MVP. That's insane. Like the fact that that's not common knowledge is just like crazy. Or like, I don't know, there's just so many interesting stories. And it goes beyond the court because, like you said, and Elena Deladon has sounded off about this before, like we follow NBA players as personalities.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily follow them as players. Like you said, like people follow LeBron or like Russ Westbrook or Steph, like, without necessarily watching them. They just know, like, they know them as the personality, and we need to see more and WNBA personalities. The other thing, like, just a quick example, I'm not gonna, you know, keep rambling on about this, but like, some, like, a story that's kind of close to me is the fact that so the New York Liberty have played at Madison Square Garden for a long time, and then this past summer the Knicks ownership, essentially, or the Madison Square Garden company, had them, I guess they weren't making enough money for their liking, so they, in my opinion, sort of banished them to, like, the Knicks training facility in Westchester, which, in my opinion, like, if you want a pro team to perform like a minor league team, you put them in a minor league sort of facility, right?
Yeah, if you don't give them the resources to succeed, then they probably won't.
Right, and I felt it, like, it was a little bit lazy. Like, I just felt like creatively there could have been something done to, like, make it more of an attraction at the Garden. I mean, it's still the Garden. Now, the Knicks ownership has since sold that franchise to the minority stakeholder in the Nets ownership, which I'm actually excited about, because as we know, the Nets are kind of like, they've got a lot of interesting stuff going on right now. You know, they're doing well. They're ahead of schedule. Brooklyn's kind of got this cool vibe to it now. And so I'm excited about that, but I was a little disappointed that to find that most of the games are still going to be in Westchester for a while. It's like, just, like, figure it out. Like, I don't know. Like, I just think there's got to be a way to make it more of a draw, and get these athletes the attention that they deserve for the fantastic feats that they're accomplishing. And I don't know. I feel like I rambled about it for a while, and maybe I haven't provided enough solutions or concrete solutions. But
no, it's good. It's good information. It's good food for thought.
Yeah, it's food for thought, and like I said, I guess what I really want to stress is that there's room in any broadcast and any website to cover these athletes, to cover them more, and I think the more awareness, the more people will actually want to tune in, and then it's a spiral effect. So, but also the WNBA management-wise, They need to address this, and the athletes in collective bargaining do need to make the conditions better, and make the revenue better, especially given the talent that's there.
I think we can all agree on that. I think most level-headed people can agree on that.
I would hope so. But like I said, there's people out there that.
No, that people there will always be people out there who just want to nag, whatever it is. Well, whatever, yeah, it is, there will just always be those people.
Well, yeah, and that's a little bit of the issue to me, is like, instead of, you know, sometimes being creative and trying to come up with solutions, it's like, that'll never work, or this doesn't work because of this, and people aren't interested. People don't want to see it. Like, come on.
Yeah, it's just not true.
What haven't we touched on, Davis?
I think that's it. I think that we got through all of the agenda. So I think you did. I think you did good.
Really? Did I pass your interesting guest test?
I mean, we'll find out. We'll find out when I get the metrics for how many people listened and downloaded to the episode and made it through the whole thing.
Now I'm nervous. We're gonna have to get Drew to blast it out to all of his followers.
I just messaged him and said that we were just about done recording, and he's excited to listen to it. So, and if it passes the Drew test, it's probably good.
Yay. Well, I sure hope, if nothing else, you were interested. It was definitely a fun conversation for me.
Pretty interesting. I appreciate very much you giving me a little bit of your time to come on and and talk. If people want to engage more with your work and hear more about what you have to say, where can they do that?
Well, go ahead and follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Maria C. Marino. If you do the Facebook thing, it's Maria Catherine Marino. Also, I would just a heads up that from here on out, actually within the next several days, I'm starting a full-time role with Sportsnet New York. So if you get SNY or you follow SNY, that's where you'll see me. Try not to get choked up. I won't be doing, you know, Fantasy Sports Network content, at least for the foreseeable future. So, yeah, that's it. Bit of breaking news in the media world.
There we go. Breaking it on this podcast.
Pretty much.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was fun.